Hey listeners, welcome back to Immigrantly. It's your host Sadia Khan and I'm thrilled to have you all tuning in for another insightful chat. Have you ever noticed how we often get stuck in labels that don't quite capture the full picture of who we are? Resilience, a term we hear often tossed around, especially when discussing marginalized communities and their struggles. I'll be honest, I've never been a huge fan of it, even though I have used it plenty of times. It's like this term turns us, and by us, I mean marginalized communities, into these superhero versions of ourselves. It kind of puts pressure on us to be unbreakable, you know. I am curious to know, what do you think? Have you felt a bit uncomfortable about the term? While you think about it, get ready to meet our guest, the host of the thought-provoking Don't Call Me Resilient podcast, who brings a unique perspective. And to be honest, when I listened to her podcast, I started thinking more about the term resilient, and hence my banter in the beginning. Vinita Srivastava is a podcast and multimedia producer, writer, and editor. She's worked in the media industry for over 25 years, working on magazines and radio shows. She's also a research associate at the Global Journalism Innovation Lab at the University of British Columbia. Today, we discuss her adventures in reporting and writing and dive into her most recent endeavor as the executive producer and host of the podcast called Don't Call Me Resilient. So let's get started. So how's Toronto?
Toronto is actually, it's a beautiful city. And today it's like beautiful, actually. You got a beautiful coat of fresh snow that makes everything look really pretty.
In March.
It's in March. I know it's true. But you know, it's weird because like I didn't think I would miss snow, but then there's no snow this year and then I missed it. So it's one of those weird things. Complain about it, but then it's not here. You miss it.
I grew up in Pakistan and I never thought I would say this, but I don't like winters anymore. Having lived in the US for over 20 years.
Oh, you don't like them?
I don't like them now. I mean, I don't even like summer.
What's your favorite season though?
My favorite season is fall.
Yeah, fall is nice, and especially in the Northeast, because fall has that sort of, we change into, you know, we're good new beginnings. And then you see this change actual literally on the leaves. Everything's shedding. And
it's this visual, aesthetically beautiful change that you witness every fall. So fall is what I like. But again, winter, oh my gosh, I loved winters when I was growing up in Pakistan. And now I can't take winters in the US anymore, especially Northeast.
Well, winters there are very mild.
Oh, yeah. Oh my gosh, I think where I lived in Lahore, the temperature probably would be around 60s.
Oh yeah, that's warm.
Yeah.
I actually went skiing a couple of weeks ago, like in mid-February. We have a long weekend here. I went skiing for the first time in, I don't know, 30 years, like downhill skiing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it was beautiful. It just happened to be one of those weekends where we actually got snow where I was at the ski hill. I fell. And, you know, trust me, it's not as easy to fall the older you get, but it was good. I was inspired by somebody I know that learned how to ski as an older person. And I thought, downhill ski. And I thought, okay, well.
Why not?
Why not? I did go skiing as a teenager. I grew up in Toronto, so.
Why did you stop?
I moved to New York City. There was no skiing in New York City.
Oh. Yeah. So we used to live in Denver, Colorado. I never tried skiing. My husband did. And the mountains are beautiful there, right? And then when we moved to New York, we were like, the landscape has really changed.
Yeah.
So Vinita, you grew up in Toronto?
I did.
Talk to me about your childhood memories, your neighborhood. What was it like growing up?
It was complicated. Like now I have children. You know, my kids are 11 and 14. The crazy thing to me is that things haven't changed that much.
How so?
I thought, you know, when I was growing up, it was the 70s and the 80s in Toronto. You know, I grew up at a time, my parents immigrated here in the 60s. So there were very few South Asians here. They came separately. They met here at a party and married here. So growing up was pretty interesting in that my parents came from two different regions in South Asia, in India, and had a very kind of progressive kind of outlook on life. My dad was a university professor. My mom was a scientist, although she gave up her job to raise us kids. But the amount of racism that we experienced as a family, as kids growing up in school, the idea that now when I think about the diversity around us, I'm like, well, it's so much more. So things must have changed. You know, my kids who are mixed race, they're mixed East Asian and South Asian. When they're at school, I just did not expect to hear such similar stories from them. You know, coming from teachers, for example, singling out the kid in the classroom about their religion or about their race or about their name, or comments from kids as young as like 10, that this racism still kind of, this otherness, this idea of being tried to made to feel like other is still there. You asked me how was it growing up? Like I experienced that all the time. The attempt of being othered, you know, you get name called, you know, at that time that was the Packy era, right? Packy was like a slur that was basically invented by the Toronto Star. You know, it was like a headline in the Toronto Star and like, boom, that was like, yeah, that's a great name for the new immigrants in Canada. We'll just call them all Packies. And that became this very negative, you know. So that was the Packy bashing era. And, you know, that moved on into that was also called the dot busting era in the 80s, where women in saris and bindis were getting pushed off the subway platforms in Toronto and also in New Jersey and probably New York City, too. So I grew up in that era. And, you know, we talk about the rise of the white supremacy. Well, it's always been there. So it was very much like very visually evident in Toronto in the 80s and the 90s when I was in university as well. So that's how I grew up. And as a result, I think from as young as I would say 14, 15, I started a group called Students and Teachers Against Racism at my high school. So it was something that I just, you know, it's almost like, what other kind of response are you supposed to have to that? You have to start to deal with it.
So what did that group do?
Well, Students and Teachers Against Racism actually was a citywide. It was amazing, to be honest with you. We had such a great, at that time, the school board in my city, which is Toronto, we're talking about, created this multicultural leadership workshop where they got students, racialized students from schools, high schools across the city, and we met at this leadership camp. At that camp, I learned all kinds of things that I'd never heard about. I heard about the Sharpeville massacre, the massacre of innocent protests in South Africa. I heard about how Indigenous people were treated in Canada, things I did not know, you know, and it really helped to open my eyes and things that, you know, helped me connect it to things that I was experiencing just as a little kid, being called chocolate or packy. You don't really understand that this is connected to a larger system.
But you were only 14, Vinita. How did that influence you into becoming who you are today?
First of all, the collaboration, the citywide collaboration with all the other kids was pretty amazing. And the fact that we did it as kids without, you know, we have, of course, had to go seek a teacher, advisor, but we weren't really led by an adult. We were very much leading ourselves. And that was a real fantastic, wonderful start to my, you know, anti-racist activism days and to my anti-racist activism life, because it was so joyful, you know, like it was so lovely to meet all these other people across the city and to hear about how different their lives were. And so that Students and Teachers Against Racism grew. And once I left high school, I helped to start a group in Toronto inspired by a Michigan group called the United Coalition Against Racism. And we started a Toronto chapter, the Toronto Coalition Against Racism. And that was my university days.
When did you move to New York?
I moved to New York soon after I graduated my undergraduate. We were going through a recession here in Ontario. And also, I had applied everywhere. I really knew that I wanted to be a journalist. I had started writing as a student, but I got interviews, but no job. I tried everything. And it's a combination of recession, but also I didn't go to journalism school. I studied women's studies. I studied English. And this was at the advice of my parents. My grandfather was a journalist in India. And both my parents said, you know what, get the grounding of like a good understanding, you know, get the analytical tools that you need first, and then maybe go be a journalist. You don't necessarily need to study it. So I studied other things, theory, but I couldn't get a job. So I think the combination was, yes, it was a recession. Yes, I had no degree in journalism, although at that time when I was looking, journalism was a trade. And also, I am a racialized woman. And so there were very few examples in front of me. Very few of journalists in Canada.
Was it the 90s when you moved to New York?
Yeah. So I moved to New York. I landed an internship, like, I don't know how, but I miraculously landed an internship at the Village Voice, which was one of my favorite outlets, weekly newspaper.
How was New York City different from where you grew up in terms of race relations, in terms of treatment of people of color? At the time, in the 90s, did you experience it differently? Was it similar?
We're talking about the racial map of, first of all, the United States, but even just talking about New York City, the racial map of New York City was very different than Toronto. And by the time I left Toronto, I was very involved in many organizations. So Desh Pardesh was a huge organization in Toronto, home away from home, that means, and it was the politics of being South Asian in Canada, what that meant, how did we create allies, you know, with other communities, allyships? How did we talk about our identity? Desh Pardesh attracted all kinds of people globally, but especially from LA and from New York City. When I went to New York City, I was expecting an equally dynamic, large South Asian active community. And what I saw was quite different. It was much more nascent. It was a younger, politically younger community. In that way, I was able to just jump right in. There was still room, so I could jump in and add my voice to the mix there. But the race politics were very different. First of all, now the Black population in New York City has decreased, but at that time it was quite large. And just one of the things that was very obvious to me at that time, it's you'd see a lot of diversity on the streets, not necessarily in the newsroom.
I am not surprised at all. But you do see a lot of diversity in New York, even now. New York City is one place when I go there. It's not just diversity in terms of how people look physically. I can hear so many accents as I walk on the streets of New York City, right?
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
You know, one of the things that everybody talks about when we talk about the comparison of Toronto, I'm not saying Canada or US, but Toronto versus New York. This is just my opinion, and this is also just anecdotal what I hear from people from New York, is that when they come to Toronto, they're like, there's actually a mixing happening here. This is actually multicultural. But when you go to New York, they talk a lot about the segregation. So there's a lot of diversity on the streets, you know, in terms of the pockets, how we live, who we go to school with.
It's pretty siloed.
It's very siloed.
Yeah. Come to think of it, it is siloed. We tend to forget the role of money in all of this, right? When we think of segregation, at least in the US, a lot of people think of racial segregation, but racial segregation is also tied to socioeconomic segregation. And that's why when immigrants from different parts of the world come to the US, most immigrants who are privileged try to approximate themselves to whiteness in the US, and then they become part of those siloed groups.
I can't even talk about the swing to the far right that's happening right now.
Oh, yeah.
Like, what the hell is that?
I mean, I've lived in this country for more than 20 years, and I've never felt as othered as I am feeling right now, which to me is so sad.
I'm sorry that's happening.
For me, I have an added layer of being a Muslim woman in the U.S. And as you know, U.S. has a very interesting relationship with its Muslim diaspora. We see that play out in politics across the aisle. It doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat. And we're seeing it play out in real time, which is really, really unfortunate, I'll say. Not surprising. Unfortunate, yes.
I left the U.S. like, say, 4 or 5 years after 9/11. So I was there through 9/11. I was working at the New York Times in the New York Times newsroom, and I watched all the unfolding of that reporting. And I thought, wow, the Islamophobia is so bad right now, post 9/11, right?
Yeah.
I just feel like what you're talking about then must be like this exponential rise.
Oh my gosh, yeah. There's been like this consistent anti-Muslim propaganda. Not that it didn't exist before 9/11, but as you said, it just grew exponentially.
Oh yeah.
And now it's normalized, right? People who are seemingly liberal or more inclusive somehow cannot see humanity in people who identify as Muslims. So when I came to the U.S., this was post 9/11 era, and I've only seen U.S. as this resentful, paranoid state post 9/11. I don't know what it looked like in the 90s or the 80s. I've heard stories, but I really thought that it would eventually go away.
Sorry, I don't mean to laugh. That's sweet though, but yeah.
I mean, I get it why you're laughing, but I really did think that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I felt the same way too. I guess that's, we started off by saying that, like, obviously I thought similar things. You know, my kids last night were telling me stories and they could see it on my face, right? That I'm like, I'm going to write to that teacher. And they're just like, Mama, calm down. Don't analyze this. We just want to tell you the story. We don't want you to take action. We don't want you to analyze it. We just want to unburden ourselves from these ridiculous stories that happened to us just today. Not like this a week or this year, but just today. I'm like, I can't believe the amount of racism that they encounter in a day.
You know, what's interesting to me is my girls do the same. Both of them are in college now, by the way. And to me, it's like, if we don't take action, then how do we assert ourselves and our agency? Like, we cannot remain quiet anymore.
I think that's why they're telling me to be quiet. Because they know that that's exactly what I do. I immediately, you know, I write to the teacher, I write to the principal, I'll call the parent. But I think at some point, they're just like, can we just chill with this for a minute and just take a pause and just listen to my experience and not necessarily have to do anything about it? And I think, you know, there's wisdom in what our children are asking for as well.
This is a great segue into your podcast, Vinita. It's called Don't Call Me Resilient. What inspired the title of your podcast?
The time that we were looking for a name of the podcast, it was right in the middle of COVID. And everybody at that time was talking about resiliency, resilient cities. You know, there were all these reports coming out about resilient people. Yet another report came out about unclean water at a First Nations community in Canada. Another one. There's so many. And at that time, it's okay. These communities are resilient. You know, they can survive. I'm like, really? This, 3 generations, 4 generations of health problems, of health issues that are easily preventable in a, you know, in a first world country. We shouldn't be having communities dealing with basically poisoned water that our government can fix. And so I started thinking about that. I was getting really, really sick and tired of hearing the government talk about, you know, communities are resilient. We're whole cities are resilient now because we're dealing with COVID. And it's like a little bit of a brainwashing kind of thing that's happening there. And then, you know, we started hearing it again around then. That was the time of George Floyd's murder as well. So we're talking about that whole era where we had COVID, then we had George Floyd's murder and the rise of the resurgence of anti-Black racism And so Black Lives Matter, but also all the movements that came before that, that resurgence, just you saw it on the streets. And it's this idea of, well, people aren't bulletproof. People, like, disease is not just one generation. It hits, you know, you kill a community, you kill people in that community, that lasts for generations. You poison a well, it lasts for generations. So that's where it came from, this idea that instead of talking about the resilience of communities and of people and of cities, can we start talking about solutions and stop making resilience your go-to catchword? I never want to say that we're not resilient. And I think that's kind of the danger of saying, don't call me resilient, is that I don't mean to say that we are not resilient.
I totally get it. Honestly, when I read it, I was like, yeah, absolutely. Because the term resilient or resilience is putting burden on being superheroes on communities of color, right? So, oh, they are resilient. They can bear the burden. They can bear the racialized idea of who they are. They can bear the Islamophobia. They can bear all of that because they are resilient. You know, they'll bounce back. That is extremely problematic to me. But you said this is a way to brainwash. What do you mean by that?
I mean, for those in power who have the control, instead of really thinking about what is a possible long-term solution that might last beyond, you know, your time in office, because that's part of the problem, we're going to put out a report that just lets you know how strong you are. And, you know, it's racialized communities, it's communities living in poverty, having to deal with putting food on the table. It's all kinds of communities that they're saying, don't worry, you are resilient, you are good, you've got this. And I think that's what I mean by brainwashing.
Is there a situation where calling someone resilient is okay?
Well, we are resilient, so we always want to say, yes, you are resilient. Congratulations for being resilient. Maybe you're calling me resilient, but you're giving me $1 million to fix things. Or you're calling us resilient, but you're giving us a fixed basic income so we can feed our families. Or you're calling us resilient, but you're actually putting proper DEI laws in place. Well, then maybe that's okay.
Why do you think we can't be strong through vulnerability? Why do we have to be resilient? Why do we have to bounce back every time?
That question is really interesting because just personally, I feel like I've had to show all of this resilience, you know, as this person at the helm of this very underfunded podcast and really pushing through and really fighting for space in my own media organization and really just like, I'm okay. And then I sort of hit December or January and I'm, you know what? Actually, I'm not okay. I'm tired. I'm a little burnt out. I'm angry. I'm frustrated. I'm sick and tired of being marginalized. You know, I'm sick and tired of having to fight for space and budgets. Not to say that everybody else doesn't do this, but just on a personal level, that idea of, wait, this is very ironic that I'm running this podcast called Don't Call Me Resilient. And yet I'm forcing myself to be resilient just within my own milieu. And I feel that I really had to teach myself to say out loud, it's okay. I need to put things down for a time. I need to take a rest. We've been talking a lot about rest as resistance and also a lot about naming things, naming the need to take a rest, naming the need to take time out to grieve, because yesterday or the day before we put out this episode about the starvation in Gaza. And it's a very intense interview.
Israel is deliberately keeping the humanitarian aid in as difficult as possible. And we are fighting with time right now. We have a very little time. And we have 1 million people, 50% are in severe danger.
The scholar who's speaking is a former UN special rapporteur on the right to food in the United Nations. And she says, basically, even if we have ceasefire now in Gaza, this is a lost generation. There's no way to save this generation because of famine, because even if people get food, children under 12, if they're malnourished for more than 3 months, do not have the capability of developing. It's going to impact generationally, it's going to impact these poor folks. And so just taking in that information, you know, I'm an outsider to this issue, but even just listening to it, you need to take a moment to grieve that information and mourn and sit down and just take a pause and not be resilient, not be resilient with it.
That's a great point. Why isn't this information resonating with folks, with the broader audience populations in the US, Canada, in the Western world, except for the youth?
I actually think it is resonating. I think that most recent surveys say that more than 60% of Democratic voters want a ceasefire in the United States. I do think that there is a very large percentage of the public who is now more aware than they were 6 months ago.
So maybe it's not resonating with the government.
That's about power. That's about a history of colonialism and imperialism and racism that is very, very entrenched in our systems. I think that's partly it. I think it's about fear. I mean, I think even if you look at the people of Israel, many, many, many of them do not support their current leader or government. People are calling for a ceasefire. So the media does report on, oh, some Israelis are blocking humanitarian aid. That's just some. There's thousands and thousands marching in the street for peace also. You know, I laughed at you for being an optimist, but I guess I am too.
Yeah, no, you're right. But at the same time, what really bothers me is that it took around deaths of 40,000 Palestinians for people to pay attention. In any other situation, pick any other situation, these numbers would have been much less for the international community, especially the Western community, to pay attention. And that shows the kind of dehumanization that happens around Palestinian identity in the Western world, right?
Of course.
I mean, if they can't pay attention now, if they don't recognize it now, then we've lost humanity forever. Imagine 40,000 deaths anywhere, starvation of 1 million people anywhere, and the situation would be so different. It would not even get to that point ever.
It's true, especially such a man-made disaster. We know that international communities have stood by it and watched genocide in Rwanda, Myanmar, and other places.
We forget that, you're right.
But Gaza is particularly different in that it's entirely man-made and it's extremely punitive.
Vinita, I want to pivot a little and talk about your work as a journalist. Now, you've been working on many media platforms throughout your career, right? And you've reported from different places, including Mumbai and Johannesburg. What are some of the similarities or differences you observed in reporting from all these different places?
Oh, well, it's funny that you ask about similarities because we're talking about famine. I've just recently been trying, like I make all these links in my head, you know, when we're talking about the colonialist playbook. You're asking me about reporting from different places. We're just making the links right now, you know, between the famine in Bengal, famine of 1943, which was manufactured by the British in India, and 3 million people died. And then we look at the famine in Canada. The architect was John A. Macdonald, who was the leader, first prime minister of Canada. And so, you know, you're asking me about similarities. These are some of the similarities that I start to see when I'm looking at these. Of course, all of these places are so different. I'm thinking about my reporting from Brooklyn, some of the communities that I saw there, particularly in the public housing. Reporting from New Jersey, from Newark, the issues are very similar. The idea of who is living in public housing, who is forced to live there, who lives on Martin Luther King Boulevard, who lives on Malcolm X Street. These are Black communities across. I saw them in Baltimore. I saw them in New Jersey. I saw them in New York City. I saw them in Memphis. Then I went to Soweto, where the ravages of apartheid was still very, very evident and very clear. Who's living in Soweto is Black Africans. So yeah, the similarities are there of who are the oppressed groups.
What gives you hope?
That's a hard question right now, to be honest. That glimmer of hope that I've been looking for. I guess what gives me hope is that what I see out there in the world, when I see, for example, protesters of Cop City in Atlanta, I see the protest tactics constantly being innovated, you know, constantly like being, you know, conducted in really thoughtful ways. All of the protests that we're seeing for peace around the world right now, I look at those and I look at the techniques that people are using, including singing and calling spiritual energy to their protests. We're talking about intergenerational trauma, but there's also intergenerational strength and joy. So when I look at the protests and I look at protesters who say, we're going to draw strength from our intergenerations, we're going to call on our ancestors to help us with this protest. We're going to continue to protest, even though the tactics are getting stronger and stronger from the other side. I mean, people are opening fire onto protesters. People are throwing gas at protesters, whatever they used in New York City at Columbia University on those protesters. I mean, in Cop City, they're getting arrested. They're getting thrown with, you know, all kinds of laws are getting thrown at them. So protest is being curtailed in all kinds of legal ways as well. But I just see people just getting right back up. And so that does give me a lot of hope.
I've listened to a few episodes of your podcast. They are incredible. You talk about so many different things, from race to culture to intersectionality of both. Have you had a guest who really inspired you? One guest who stood out that you want to share a story about?
Oh my gosh, that's such a hard question, because honestly, I have learned so much from the guests of Don't Call Me Resilient. They are just wonderful people, scholars, activists out there really doing the work. If we're talking about who gives me hope, these folks are incredible. Sometimes I go back and I put together we have these little, like, you know, Facebook pages that we put together, like little collage of all the faces of people that we've interviewed. And I love looking at it. It's, first of all, it's such a diverse group. If I write to them as a group and I ask them, hey guys, I'm making a playlist, I want your favorite song, send it. Everybody writes. It's like just such a lovely, beautiful group. I'm going to tell you about two people that I think really stood out for me. One of them is Reverend Kyodo Angel Williams, not a scholar, but in many ways a scholar of Buddhism, and not even maybe necessarily of a formal Buddhist tradition anymore, as a Black woman had some trouble in that institution as well. She talks about being an activist in the world and how to take care of yourself and be in the world at the same time in this way. And she was the one, I believe, that encouraged me to put things down sometimes. Sometimes you have to put things down. And how to be in the world in a way that is aware, allows you to act from your gut and your instinct, and allows you to really contribute to the movement, you know, that we need to be contributing to. And I have to say, I've already talked about Hilal Elver, but the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, who I spoke with this week, was very inspiring. She's been at this work for decades, talking about the right to food. And even with everything that we're seeing, and even with what she's talking about, with the fact that mass death is imminent due to famine, and the fact that she gets up and does that work every day and will continue to do that work, you know what I mean? Like, that is very inspiring.
Benita, you mentioned being an activist. I listened to one of your episodes where you talk about this with your guest. It's an interesting idea or term, right? People use it differently. How do you see activism? How do you define your activism?
I actually don't call myself an activist anymore. I should say that. I do understand sometimes that term exists. And I have said it in the beginning when I talked about the beginning of my anti-racist activist journey. And I really very much was an activist. Now, I'm a journalist, I'm a writer, I'm a researcher, I'm a producer, I'm a former fact checker for the New York Times, you know what I mean?
They need another fact checker right now, they do. What a disappointment.
Yes. You know, the thing about the fact checking at the New York Times is somebody who worked there, you know, the newspaper doesn't get fact checked. Only certain parts of that place get fact checked. I know exactly what gets fact checked and what doesn't. So
I'm curious what does and what doesn't.
I can tell you, but so for me, when I say I'm a journalist, I'm a objective journalist.
Hmm.
And I'm reporting and talking about and interviewing people who have taken deep dives. Everybody I interview at the podcast is a scholar in some kind of way. And if they're not a scholar, they've got somebody with extensive experience in that area. I think people have this idea of like, you can't be a journalist and an activist. Of course you can. And there's all kinds of people who are that.
Why don't you use the term activist for yourself anymore?
Well, to me, an activist is somebody who's really out there organizing and activating. And I don't do that anymore.
Yeah, but activism comes in different forms and shapes, right? Just recognizing everybody's humanity and working to fight for it, not in silos and not cause-based, but bringing your whole self to it, right? And recognizing somebody else's whole identity and whole self is a form of activism, at least in this day and age.
It is complicated because I really do see myself as that objective producer, journalist. Although you say that to somebody else, they'll be like, what are you talking about? You're a journalist who approaches journalism through critical race. The Don't Call Me Resilient podcast, we look at the news every week, but through a critical race lens. And that's an intersectional lens. And that is just how I see the world. Sometimes when I'm talking, like my partner is like, is that about race, Vinita? I'm like, well, what's not about race? I don't know. What's not about gender? What's not about race? What's not about money? Like they all intersect.
Vinita, in the end, if you were to define Canada in a word or a sentence, how would you do that?
The fascinating thing for me is, again, I'm reading a book right now about the history of Canada, and it is fascinating because basically what it's saying is more than half of the Indigenous population that was here in Canada was decimated, either through famine, you know, colonial laws, war, disease. Is a confluence of things that have done that. So I am really thinking about Canada in a very different way than this very linear, one-sided history that I was taught. Canada, to me, is porous. We're dealing with a nation that has a false border. Like, I don't mean to make everything so complicated, but it is complicated. I am Canadian. I live in Canada. I am a settler, you know, in many ways here myself. And as I say, it's a history that is like thousands of years old. It's a land with a very complicated history. It is rich and beautiful and gorgeous. And I do love many of my fellow neighbors.
I like that. Thank you so much, Vinita. This was wonderful. Where can people find more information about your projects, your podcast? Is there a website they can go to?
So Don't Call Me Resilient is available at the don'tcallmeresilient.com. And also you can go to theconversation.com and find it there because that's our host organization. News organization is The Conversation. And you can also find Don't Call Me Resilient wherever, you know, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you so much, Vinita. This was beautiful.
It was nice to chat with you. Pleasure.
This was an important conversation. As for the term resilient that I mentioned in the beginning, I really think that calling people resilient is still okay. As long as we realize that they can be vulnerable, weak, emotional at times, and they can find strength through all those different emotions. We don't have to be resilient all the time. We don't have to bounce back all the time. We can show our emotions that exist on a spectrum. This podcast was produced by me, Sadia Khan, written by Adiba Hussain and me. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our editor and sound designer is Hazik Ahmed Farid. Theme music for Immigrantly is done by Simon Hutchinson. Don't forget to come back next week. And if you're not following us on our socials, please do. You can find information on our website, immigrantlypod.com. Take care and be well.